Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to today's podcast with three or four gold bars, depending on how you look at these amazing guests. Great conversations. Here we go with Graham Norton, Chris and Rosie Ramsey. So there's two for one. And Ronnie O'Sullivan. Enjoy, my friends. Give us the biggest of all intros, please, if you don't mind, Vassos, for the man of the moment.
Whether he's on Virgin Radio or the telly, our next guest never gets nul point. He's back on BBC One this Saturday night to Graham's Guide Us Through Eurovision live from Liverpool. It lasts 4 hours, but you wouldn't want it to shorten when it's Graham Norton.
Morning, Graham.
I wondered where we were going there.
I wonder that every morning.
Shorten Norton. I get it. Yeah.
Oh, Graham, so much to talk about. First of all, the first semi-final, Ireland were knocked out. We had actual money on Ireland because we thought their song was amazing. Were you as shocked as we were?
I really was. I felt so bad for those boys. I think one of the problems was that was such a strong semi-final. All because they do a draw for who's going to be in which one. And so all the big songs were in that semi-final. So I think that played against it. And also, there's an odd thing, because in this country, we've had Take That the whole time. Mm-hmm. We still really like that kind of anthemic pop and that sort of song. And I wonder if it played as well across the rest of Europe.
Interesting. So are you saying that tonight's semi-final is going to be rubbish?
No.
I didn't think you were. I was just being pesky.
I mean, there are some moments where you might nip to the loo. I watched the dress rehearsal last night in the stadium, and one act started, and I thought, oh, if I was at a concert, this is when I'd go get a drink. And
yeah.
As I thought that, the stadium emptied as people were going.
Really?
To get
it. Oh my goodness!
See if you can spot it.
Okay, it's so fun though, isn't it? I mean, I don't know why, but I think we're all more excited about Eurovision than we've ever been. It is the biggest pan-European light entertainment TV spectacle of all time. Now, it's fair to say that because it's true. You have a team of hosts. Hannah Waddingham is absolutely smashing it. She seems to have become Eurovision now.
No, honestly, I feel so bad because I was watching it last night. The three of them are on stage presenting, and I'm thinking, why am I going to be there on Saturday? I'm like the vegetables. You know when you have a dinner and vegetables arrive that nobody ordered?
Yes.
That's me. That'll be me on Saturday night.
Which vegetable might that be, do you think, Graham?
Well, I think it's something really unwanted, like, you know, celery in a sauce.
Yeah, or tacadal. We always order tacadal. Nobody ever touches it. I have no idea why. No, but see, what a fantastic lineup of hosts. She's inhabiting Eurovision. Obviously, she's a big fan. She's a fantastic singer, Hannah Waddingham.
She is. And actually, I think that note you heard in that first semi-final, well, that's it. She's not going to sing again, I don't think. I assume she'd be, you know, bursting to song the whole time.
Well, I think
she's great. And Alicia's rap, if people didn't see that first semi-final, Alicia's rap, I loved it.
Yeah, we have it here. We will play, but I'd just rather talk to you live for a bit. We'll play it in a moment or two. Hannah Waddingham, potential future entrant. Who knows?
Oh, maybe. Yeah, now she knows what's going on. Having said that, Mae Muller did her dress rehearsal last night.
Yes.
And I think the UK are going to be very impressed. The staging, like when you think about some of the stuff that, you know, the UK have done in the past, the staging for this is phenomenal. All these screens and visuals and dance, it's really, really good.
Is it the Mutts Nuts?
So, yeah, fingers crossed for her.
Is it the Cows Kahunas? Is it all that?
Oh, it is. It's definitely that. Yes.
All right,
yes.
Perfect. But I mean, you've done the biggest shiny floor shows imaginable. Obviously, you commentated on Eurovision a lot. You are hosting. You'll be on the biggest of all shiny floors. The production, they are so extravagant and they're so extreme and huge and magnificent. I don't know how they do it. Is it one team that just waits the whole year to be the Eurovision team?
This is a BBC team that are putting this whole show together.
Well,
and you know that thing where you're kind of thinking, because everyone said, oh, wouldn't it be great for it to be in the UK? And then finally it was. And you're like, ooh, what's it going to be like?
Yes.
So it's been amazing. It's actually, I think, one of the best Eurovisions I've ever been at. It's so well organized.
Right.
I mean, you know, all those things that people kind of slightly sneer at the BBC for, wow, they are really doing this well.
Well, the BBC are on a roll. I mean, they've had a good few days of it. You know, obviously the coronation and then the Windsor Castle concert and then Eurovision this week. Unfortunately, they've blown their budget for the whole year. But that's another conversation for another day.
Yeah, I won't be back in the autumn.
By the way, Chris and Rosie Ramsey are on in a bit. And
yes.
They are sort of not filling in for you, but the same slotting as you whilst you're not there on the Beeb. Any sort, not tips, they don't need tips, they don't need advice, but any sort of any thoughts, any parallel thoughts to go with them becoming the new Friday night BBC One 10:40 incumbents?
I mean, I just think people love them, and rightly so. They are so lovable. So I think they'll do really well. And that's a very fun show because it reminds me of things like our old Channel 4 show where we would like get guests, but then we'd play games and do all the, so they do all that sort of stuff. I think it's kind of perfect Friday night telly.
All right. I can't wait to talk to them. It's great to talk to you, by the way. What is the vibe like up in Liverpool?
It's really, really, really good. I got off the train. Like, I was up here on Friday and it was like, you know, it was all fine. And then I got off the train on Tuesday and people were already all dressed in their Eurovision final. They had the burqa hats on, they had the flag capes and things. And I just thought, it's Tuesday. What state are you going to be in by Saturday? Liverpool is en fête, as one might say.
En fête. Nice. Nice bit of class to the breakfast show for once. And if we win, of course, we get to host it again. double-edged sword, of course.
Chris. Yeah. A tent in your garden, perhaps.
Yeah. So you're talking about outfits. You're going to be centre stage, so we're going to see you as well as hear you. I know you're commentating and you're hosting on stage and you're going to sort of nip up and down. So you're going to have the busiest of all nights. Tell us about your outfit, because it is a big deal. How much are you going to be wearing on Saturday?
Oh, how much? Well, tonight, there's a semi-final tonight. I'm in a semi-final tonight. I'm doing a little cameo with Timur, the Ukrainian commentator. And tonight I'm wearing a very sparkly gold jacket by a Ukrainian company, Ukrainian designers, with all traditional Ukrainian things done into it. And then on the night, I've got a big sparkly Alexander McQueen thing.
Beautiful.
That I'm swanning around in.
Beautiful. And Mel Gedroych, when you're not in your commentary box, she's going to take over for a bit. Any advice for her?
Well, she's got the nice bit, actually, because I'm doing the songs, the 26 songs.
Right.
And then she's taking over, so she'll get the voting, which is actually the bit that I enjoy commentating on most. But me and Hannah, we're standing beside the podium and going, and now off to Zagreb. So I can't tell you how complicated it is. Why they've given it to the two of us, I don't know.
Oh, my God. I can't wait. Graham, I can't wait. I'm so excited.
Well, what is kind of, you do get a thrill even doing the rehearsal, is when you get to, and the winner is.
Yes.
And then, wow, we are actually going to be announcing that on Saturday night.
Do you feel like I do? It's not just because it's here, is it? It's not just because of Sam Ryder and Ukraine last year. Do you get the sense that because a lot of other things are falling by the wayside because they're being found out, or they just can't hold a light to like global platforms now like Netflix and Apple and Paramount, do you get the sense that as other things are sort of dying off, Eurovision is going from strength to strength, or is that just wishful thinking on my part?
I don't know, Chris. I mean, you might be right. Certainly the love for it seems undiminished. I mean, every single show in here, every semi-final, every dress rehearsal, all da-da, they are sold out, sold out, sold out. The crowds are singing along. They're just, it's amazing to feel the atmosphere in the arena. And I think that does extend out. You know, I really get a sense of it when I'm doing the commentary. You get messages through and stuff, and it's families are watching it together, and it's something that unites families with the past, because people remember sitting watching it with their parents, and like now it's nearly 70 years old, so you know, parents remember watching it with their parents. So it really it's one of those few things in life where people completely come together, everyone knows what it is, and everyone can just enjoy it for what it is.
Yeah, and it's a bit of, it's harmless nonsense, but it's uplifting. Yeah. It's effortlessly uplifting. Like you say, there's nothing not to like about it. There's nothing to fear from it. And I think that's why The Masked Singer is such a breakout hit as well. I think it's the same thing.
On paper, The Masked Singer is like, you just eye roll and you're just like, what?
Totally.
And it's one of the few things we watch every week.
I know. Yeah. It's the best. Take it off. No, don't take off. Don't take off ITV. Graham, all wonderful stuff. You do amuse me, you know, intentionally and unintentionally. Here's the unintentionally. Graham is obviously not available for his Saturday show here on Virgin Radio this weekend because he's prepping for the big show that night after also smashing two semi-finals, another semi-final live tonight with Hannah Waddingham and all the other wonderful people involved. But you are then stepping up to host your radio show on Sunday morning. Now, that's the one I would miss, and I would host the Saturday show.
Well, I would post it that as well, but I can't because of the...
You're too busy.
The dress rehearsals and stuff. I'm not physically not around. And Sunday, I mean, look, it's my hotel room. I just need to fall out of bed at 9:05.
No, it's good for us. I can't wait to hear you on Sunday morning.
Yeah, there might be more records than normal.
Well, Graham, listen, have the best time ever. You are the best of the best. Give our love to the team. Tell Hannah Waddingham we worship. Tell her to build a temple, and we'll meet her there because we all want to worship her at her altar.
Fair enough. And I will do that.
Are we concurring that Sweden is the favourite?
Sweden's the favourite, but I think Finland might win it on the night.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Conversations already underway, giggling already occurring. I'm up for a comfort break. We're just going to pick up on whatever you've been talking about to our next guest after they get their big intro from Vassos Alexander.
If there's something that annoys you about your husband or wife, there's no better way to clear the air than get a primetime TV show and tell everybody. Series 2 of the Chris and Rosie Ramsey Show begins tomorrow at 10:40 on BBC One. So please welcome the couple who make bickering glittering. It's Chris and Rosie Ramsey.
Good morning, you two.
Good morning.
What
hello.
A beautiful intro.
Welcome. So what were you talking about? Carry on that conversation.
We were discussing how to pierce ourselves for the BAFTAs on Sunday.
Oh, of course. What a great conversation.
I know. How glad are we?
Genuinely thought you said pierce for a moment.
No
I was
piercing.
Gonna have to get some piercings or tattoos or something. Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, it starts the day really, because you've got your big launch of your BBC One show now, the Chris and Rosie Ramsey Show. But then we've got Eurovision to survive.
Yes.
And then you've got to get into the BAFTAs. And if you're anywhere near Rachel on Saturday, that also includes this massive charity football match at Chesham United that we're all going to.
Yeah. Gosh. It's a lot of barocas needed. Yes. There's a lot going on, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. Well, hey, congratulations on what's already a hit show. So they're not moving it from BBC Two to BBC One as a last ditch, you know, attempt at CPR. This is because it's already a massive hit. It's been nominated for loads of stuff. Yeah. It's going to Friday night. We've just had Graham on. It's, you know, it's his slot. So, I mean, you know, what's not to like there? When he's not on, you're on. When you're not on, he's on. Congrats, your flipping lation.
Thank you so much. It's a real honour, actually. When they told, I didn't realise it was the slot. And when they told us, I was like, that is so...
I still fully believe there's been a last-minute dropout on someone else's part. Someone got ill, or someone wrote it wrong and went,
it's an honour, though. It's really good.
It's great. To keep the Graham Norton slot warm for him while he's off aid and, you know, in between series, it's brilliant.
No, it's the best, man. It's the best, you know. We want to find out when you first met, your origin story.
Yes.
Because it's always fun to go back at a certain point. And I think this now, because you've exploded anyway, but this is yet another explosion. Tomorrow, BBC One, 10:40, Chris and Rosie on their brand new, big, huge, mega TV show, already nominated for National Television Awards and BAFTAs and things like that. But how did you get together and what were you doing when you met each other?
We were 14 when we met each other.
When the first time we met each other, we were 14.
Right.
I can tell you the exact... I remember the moment, right? My friends lived around the corner in my estate. They were, quote-unquote, bigger boys. And the bigger boys were dating some girls from my year, yeah. Right? Now, as you know, at school, girls mature much quicker than boys. Yeah. So the girls in your year, they're terrifying. So they go on out with the boys who are older.
Right.
And I remember being in the house and going, oh, there's girls in the street. there's blooming girls. I can't believe it. So I went out. I think I was on my bike. And Rosie and a friend were there. And they'd stopped to speak to the group of lads who's playing the street. And they were going round the corner to see the bigger boys who they were dating.
Right.
And I just remember thinking, wow, she is... just beautiful. Gorgeous.
I didn't even see Chris, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
Did he just make all that up?
No, I didn't.
I didn't have a... No, she didn't notice us. No, Chris, she didn't notice us because I didn't have a little bum flush tash, a little bum fluff tash on my top lip. You know, and I didn't have a deep voice. I was probably the squeakiest in the street. And then we just always knew of each other.
We went to college together.
Right.
And you sat next to my boyfriend. At college.
Yeah, I copied off your boyfriend in maths.
Yeah.
A-level maths. Why did I pick that?
Not just the maths.
Yeah, I did, yeah. And I used to walk past you in one of the corridors and we always used to say hello and I always used to think, oh my God, that's that girl. And I always remembered. And then...
And our paths just kind of crossed throughout life. And then we got together about 10 years later.
Yeah.
And we got engaged after 6 months.
Yeah.
Right, so sort of... 27, 28 years old, something like that.
Mm.
Yes.
Yeah, about that, weren't we?
26 maybe, yeah.
So you walked the full length of the counter, which is important in life, I think.
Absolutely.
You know?
We totally agree. I agree with
what
that.
What a lovely way of putting it. Yeah.
Kissed
a lot of frogs.
Always. Yeah. Regardless of what
walked
you're shopping
the full
for
length of
or
the
you're
counter.
Perusing, walk the full length of the counter. Have a little look, you know. No need for the hot sell or the cold call in. And then, because Rachel, you were wondering what Rosie was up to at different times in her career when... Chris was clearly being a stand-up.
Yeah, so what were you doing when Chris was doing stand-up?
So I started off as a Pontins Blue Coat. And then
I've
been singing and dancing around like pubs and clubs and holiday camps and abroad for years. So then when we did get together finally, because we're from a small town, there's not many people who gig Friday, Saturday, Sundays, but we both did. So it was like we got it for the first time ever. Yeah. It was like, oh, you do this as well. And it just worked because all of our other partners had just been like, when are you going to get a proper job?
Yeah. It's like
very
I finally found
so.
Someone who understood that I couldn't go to that family christening because I had a gig in Grimsby. Do you know what I mean? Like, but no one else gets it.
Yeah.
And then someone got it and it was just like, wow, you get it.
All the weekend telly videoed for Monday and Tuesday.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Well, Monday and Tuesday is our weekend.
No, exactly.
For years, it's been our weekend.
The
we go for
fun.
Meals on Monday nights.
Less people around, everything's cheaper.
It's great. We're out getting drunk on a Monday
Pumped
night.
Pumped yourself.
Yeah, well, we used to be before kids, but
the rest of the world's at work. I mean, that is the thing, isn't it? You know, same when I was DJing around the clubs and the pubs, same kind of thing. And you get that weekend vibe. And the thing is, people say, oh, but you have to work at the weekend. But to be honest, you know, when it gets half 10, 11 o'clock, we can still drive. And by the way, we're getting paid to do what you do, but not feel as bad as you
that is so
might
true.
Or probably will the next day.
Yeah, that is true.
I mean, we've made up for it since, haven't we, boys and girls?
Yeah.
Right, so tipping points in your sort of joint career. Or maybe the biggest tipping point in maybe your career first, Chris? Let's have a little chronology here.
My first sort of big break,
right,
two. My first live break came when I supported Al Murray.
Right.
The pub landlord, he took me on tour. I was his only support act. Went on tour with him. That was amazing. And then I got me big break, Russell Howard's Good News.
Right.
And I only filmed a stand-in stand-up slot.
Yes.
Because I was only there that day to watch the warm-up guy, but someone messed up and I had to do the stand-in slot. And then someone else messed up on their stand-up the next week and mine ended up going on telly like easily 6 months before it should have.
Oh my goodness me, that's so interesting. So in America, the equivalent of that would have been, isn't so much nowadays, but would have been, you know, smashing it, killing it, crushing it for 4 minutes on Johnny Carson or something
like that.
Yeah.
Did it feel like that for you? Because if it did, I would imagine you were more nervous or aware of the importance of it than otherwise.
Yeah, it was a bizarre series of events that led to it. And then I remember the comedian who was supposed to go out, he phoned us and he went, when you did your slot, what was the pushback? What was the kind of, what reach did you get when you did the slot? And I went, I haven't done it. Mine didn't go on telly. Mine's just a backup. And he went, oh, mine, there was a technical error with mine, so yours will go out tonight. And it went out, and it was just this Facebook at the time I was on, and it was just this huge influx of followers and things. And then people started coming to gigs, and I was like, I could do a little tour here. And it was just one of their moments. So eternally grateful for Russell Howard for letting us on there.
So in its own way, new media has always been your friend, hasn't it? I suppose.
Yeah, but sort of MySpace comedy was the first thing, a little MySpace comedy page with things filmed on a camera, then Facebook, and then obviously podcasting became
social
the next
media,
one.
Yeah,
for you, is Insta, would that be
Instagram,
fair?
Instagram, yeah.
So tell us about your first ever Insta post and the thoughts behind that and the speed with which things exploded after for you.
So,
and then together, obviously.
So my Instagram is still very much my own personal page that I've had for 15 years.
Right.
And when Chris was away, I left my job in radio and I looked after our son, and I was just went a little bit crazy, if I'm honest with you. And I started doing just stories on Instagram, but I only had like 500 followers.
To camera, video pieces?
To the video.
Like
just
what, for example?
Like vlogs, just kind of just talking about our day and just day-to-day things. And it was a little bit like therapy, but then I started getting more and more followers.
So like you'd have your phone?
Yeah.
You'd be sitting somewhere in the house, in the kitchen?
Usually in the house.
And how long would the video be?
Throughout the day, I'd probably do about 2 minutes worth of video footage of just Robin and I, my son, and just kind of, you know, doing little bits and bobs. And
you post them as you go?
And I would post them as I go.
Right.
But at the beginning, it was just to my friends and family, and I honestly think they thought I was having a breakdown.
Well, sorry to interrupt you, but the evolution of this that Rosie didn't realise was, at first, my mates were going, hey, your lass is funny on Instagram, like, your lass is funny.
Right.
So that started happening. I was like, all right. And obviously I was watching them anyway. Then I'm doing TV shows and makeup artists and mainly female producers and people behind the scenes were going, oh my God, I love your wife. Your wife's amazing on Instagram. Oh my God. So it went from
good
your
voice,
lass is funny
way.
To, oh my God, your wife's amazing. I love your wife. What, amazing.
So because they weren't punchlines. They were just, it's just Rosie being Rosie.
It's exactly what it was.
Yeah.
Best way to describe it. It was just Rosie being Rosie.
So what did they find funny and amusing and captivating about
it? Just, they loved the way you went on. They loved your different videos, Rosie. They were just like, it was how real you were. And I think it still sort of shines through now, as people said it to us last night after the show, of how like we haven't changed in any way because we surround ourselves with mates who wouldn't let we change.
It's very hard to do, but it's very healthy.
It'd be impossible. Yeah, I've got some of my mates I've had since I was six. Like, we live in the same street. Our kids go to their grandparents' houses and it's in the same street. Like, my son can't get his head around the fact that three of his mates their grandparents live in the same street as my grandparents. You know what I mean? Because we all lived in this estate.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was just Rosie being Rosie and you were just filling the time messing on.
Just give us like three subjects from, for example, that you might visit.
What I did on Instagram.
Yeah, so.
Oh my gosh, I'm talking, I would be at the Soft Play, but I found a Soft Play that sold alcohol, so I started going to this Soft Play.
Already funny.
I was like, I can't believe I found a soft play with alcohol. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Soft Play arms.
So I would go there like three times a week, and I would just kind of like vlog whilst I was there, going, "This is the best Soft Play. Everyone needs to come." And it was just chatting about potty training, and because Robin was growing up, and I would do dances, and because I was a blue coat and I've done all of that stuff.
Yeah.
I just needed like an outlet and I wasn't working and I just felt a bit...
And I went back on tour when Robin, our first born, he was 10 days old when I went back on tour.
Yeah.
And she had a C-section. So you were stir crazy, weren't you?
I was, yeah. Being a full-time mum, I think it's the best thing ever, but it's hard.
What was the first occasion where you did something together?
Facebook Lives, when you were promoting your TV show.
Yes, I was promoting my TV show from Comedy Central years ago and I was doing Facebook Lives and Rosie was basically heckling from the sidelines, just heckling in. And everyone was like, your wife's hilarious. And then by the end, we were doing them together.
Yeah.
And then, but we did Married to a Celebrity Survival Guide thing.
We did a couple of little telly things,
We did a parenting thing for Channel 4 where they just came and filmed in the house. It wasn't... the first main thing Rosie did on telly was hosting, co-hosting the first episode of the Chris and Rosie Ramsey Show on BBC Two last year.
I'd never done anything.
Wow.
And smashed it. And like, yeah,
clearly.
Our director said last night, our director Peter Ortney's a legend, he said last night, there's no reason she should have been that good the first time she did that.
Peter Orton?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's your director?
Yeah, yeah,
oh
yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Peter Orton.
It's a dream team, man. Jeez. So you've already recorded tomorrow's show last night?
Yes.
Well, you seem in a pretty good mood, so it must have gone quite well.
It went really well. We had the audience was amazing. We had great guests.
This is so cool.
And we had loads of fun, actually.
We can actually tell you who we had, actually. We had we got Joel Dommett and Hannah Dommett.
Yep.
And Al Murray did the Please Keep Me Anonymous.
Brilliant.
And it was wonderful, yeah, really funny. But the audience make it. Everyone who comes to that show says that it's not like a TV record, it's like a live show, because the audience
are
so good.
Which is what
you
want, isn't it?
They're so good.
What time do you record?
Ooh, we're supposed to start at 7, but we started 7:15 because I was getting my hands tanned.
Which you have to do. So, because otherwise they won't match your overmade face.
Exactly.
That was exactly the thing, yeah. Especially if you're like us.
It's unbelievable.
So what time do you finish?
We were done by about 9:30, I think.
9:15.
9:15.
And you're here bright as a button. This is the way to do it, isn't it? I want it every night. I want you on every night. I mean, you know, James Corden's just vacated this massive chair in America, hasn't he?
Oh, my gosh.
I mean...
Is he coming home?
What? Is he coming home?
Yeah, he's coming home.
Yeah. Wow.
That's why he's done it. He's come home because he's, you know, he says time doesn't do refunds. You know, my dad's not getting any younger.
We still live in the north.
He's such a wise... He's so wise, James.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you can't go over there and just pick up and take
with this accent, you're joking, aren't you?
I know. They have to subtitle every episode.
Oh, my goodness me. Right, so what are the weekends? So what's going on with you in the BAFTAs?
I don't know if I'll say it yet, but we'll say it anyway. We're presenting an award. We're presenting an award at the BAFTAs.
Yeah, we're not there for any award ourselves.
No,
but
I've
never been, so I'm really looking forward to it. And we don't go to many award stuff.
Nah.
We kind of avoid them, but I'm looking forward to this one because I think it's going to be quite...
It was on Rosie's list
fancy.
Of ones she would go to.
Yeah.
So what's the plan? I mean, tell us what you want. Don't tell us anything you don't want. Don't really mind. This BBC One series was commissioned, or the show was recommissioned before the first show had really sort of even begun to finish, because people knew, they know a hit, TV people know a hit, of course they do, and they're so grateful of one nowadays, because you don't know, it's so difficult.
It is.
And there's so much amazing telly out there now.
Yeah.
So because you are global, so your podcasts are global. Instagram is global. It just is. There's not Instagram UK. There's not Podcast UK. So you're on BBC One, which of course is as good as it gets anywhere around the world, but it's not as global as your podcasting and your Instagram.
Uh-huh.
So could that, because this BBC worldwide, could that go global? Could that be on Netflix? You know, because that's where we are nowadays, isn't it? What do you think about the future?
No idea.
I mean, we honestly, sorry. No, no, go.
We just live in this little weird world of like just stuff happens, and you kind of just have to take it as it comes. And
we're just riding the roller coaster. I swear, we thought we were going to do 6 episodes of our podcast, and every time we finish recording a podcast, we turn it off and we look at each other and we go, was that good? And I go, well, you were funny. And she'll go, well, you were funny. And we'll go, all right, we'll see. And then every week it goes to the top of the podcast charts, you know, and we'll go, okay, then people must still like it. And it sounds like we're being sort of deliberately naive or trying to sort of back your question. And we're not. We've got another arena tour in the autumn, and we're just going to see if people keep listening, we'll keep doing it. If not, we'll do something else.
Yeah, you're not being deliberately naive. And by the way, people aren't deliberately naive. They're faux naive. And you're not that. Because it's obvious when people... By the way, it works. Nothing wrong with that, but it's an act.
Clearly
it's not an act.
You're so jaded by this industry, it's coming off your sheets.
No, I'm not jaded by it. So, I promise you, I'm not. I think it's fascinating. And I think, you know, the fact that you take your podcast and you do this arena tour and you think, okay, what do you have to do to turn that into this? Answer?
What, to turn a podcast into an arena show?
By the way, a sellout arena tour.
Production.
An extended dates arena tour.
Yeah.
Production. Production.
How does that work?
We knew it was going to be a live podcast, but that is only one element of it. You cannot expect to sit at a table and talk the way we're talking now in an arena and expect the guy and lady on Rose ZZZ to actually be.
So where does the show come from then?
Well, we wanted it's a bit kind of jazz hands, and I don't know whether that's a little bit of my past.
Oh, there's definite blue coatage in there.
Nice.
So, because we said with the show, we were like, we could just sit and do the podcast. And I was like, nobody wants to sit and watch two in an arena.
Not an arena.
So we've added a little bit of production, spent a bit of money, and it's a good show. It's like, it's an all-round show.
The first one was good, and the second one, we're going to go bigger and better. We've got some massive plans for the second arena.
What might be bigger?
Oh, I don't know,
that you can tell us about.
Oh, gosh, I don't even... Oh, the end. Hopefully the end.
The end.
Oh, yeah, the end.
A bigger end.
A bigger end. And I wrapped Boom Shake the Room at the end of the last one with full production, so...
And people love
happened.
Oh, do you know, very proud of you for that, because actually, that's, Chris is... Like, comedians are a little bit too cool for school, most of them.
Yeah.
Well, and that took a lot to get you to do that.
Yeah,
so well done.
Various meetings when I went, I'm not doing it. I feel sick. I'm like, I'm not doing it. I can't do it. And then by the end, I'm like, yo, back up now. We're giving...
Do you have the date scheduled for the next tour? Do you know?
Yeah, they're all in.
Yeah, they're all.
Yeah, they're all in.
How many venues are you playing?
I think we're playing about 12 or 14 arenas all over the UK. Wow. We've got Wembley.
It's cool, isn't it?
Yeah. It's really cool.
It's really cool.
You seem to be so comfortable about it all. And do you get nervous? Do you get any anxiety at all, Rosie?
So last night, all day yesterday.
Really?
I was really nervous.
So we're getting the relieved and relaxed, Rosie.
Yeah, this is, we've done the show, the first show, it's fine. But as soon as we got out there, it was fine. But I really trust Chris.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a good pair of
hands.
He's
a good driver, isn't he?
He's a really good driver. Yeah. And he knows what he's doing, and it makes me feel a lot
more appreciative, aren't you?
Well, you know, she's never said the sentence good driver, because obviously she means in an entertainment sense this time. If she was talking about an actual car, she'd tell you it was a terrible driver, because she's
horrendous.
The worst passenger ever.
No, you are a horrendous driver.
No, it is. I trust you, and I know you can be funny, and you trust me, and you know what, and it's just, it's nice having someone, you know, you trust a co-host or whatever, but there's only so far you can trust an actual co-host who you just work with, but we're married and
we can be horrendous. Horrendously awful to each other, and it's fine. Like we kind of sometimes, not like in the TV, we can snap at each other, and you're not going to sit and get really annoyed because we do.
And because you're the sort of 80-20 of your appeal is you guys. All right, so you take the show on tour, you do a rap, you do some funny stuff, you have some great ideas on the telly show, and they are brilliant ideas, which is difficult because if you come up with a sort of preconceived idea on a TV show, it can stick out like a sore thumb sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm sure some of them were in the pilot and the best ones have survived and all this kind of stuff.
Totally,
but
right.
We love you because of you, right? Which means that there could be a lot less production, a lot less sort of premeditated ideas, written ideas, and you two could just sit on a sofa every day, you know, and take what the world has to you know, as you wake up each, look at you, each morning, and we'd have you 5 days a week, and those shows are brilliant, and that's sort of what you do anyway, but you just shine brighter lights on and turn the volume up.
I know why you're laughing though.
Why?
Well, because most of the show, the BBC really trusted us, actually, and I'm quite glad. We don't know what's happening in most of the show. So we get beefs from the audience, and the celebrity reads out the Please Keep Me Honest, we don't know what they are. So we wanted our reactions to be real.
Yeah, but if you were on the telly, like, in the morning, like Holly and Phil, right? Yeah. So 90-minute show, everybody, A, we'd all want to come on because it's such a happy place to be, you know. C, you'd get the A-listers because you're so popular and people love being with you. Then you'd have the extra heat of the podcast and you'd have the live tour. So you've got the Ant and Dec thing going on as well. So that's all wonderful. And then you could do like a live phone-in doing this every morning. And the last 15 minutes of the show, like, you know, that's where you get your spike anyway. And I'm like, I'm thinking,
oh my God,
this is a show waiting to happen.
Oh my gosh.
I feel like we should sign to Chris's agent.
Yeah, I feel like he's going to sign us up.
No, but I just think for me, I mean, you don't need it. Of course you don't need it. But, you know, TV companies, whether it's here or in the US or Australia or wherever, would kill for you two, because if you've got the, you know, it's about the people in front of the camera, it's about the people behind the microphones, and then all the rest comes.
But you
two are gold, man.
You're
more than gold.
Thank you.
That's so nice of you. I'm not used to getting this many compliments at this time in the morning. I think I might get a nosebleed. I've normally got children screaming at us, Chris. This is really strange.
An article in the paper today about, it's on the front page of the Times.
Oh.
Here we go.
Come on then.
It's about T2, and it says, I've got what every woman needs, says one of their writers. And she's a lady, and what she has that she thinks every woman needs is not a husband, but it's a dusband. It's a husband that does.
A dusband. I love that.
This is right up your street, isn't it?
Yes.
I'm absolutely a dusband. I realised last night when we were on the TV show, right? I realised that I am the host of the show, but I'm also Rosie's personal runner.
Yeah.
I swear, I was walking up and down the stairs at the television centre so much. Someone actually said, "Oh, you're right." I'm walking past. I'm getting an ibuprofen. I'm getting a case. I'm getting a different shoes.
I don't want to have to ask somebody.
So, yeah,
to
so
get
she won't
things.
Ask the person whose job it is because she feels like, you know, she feels like she
you're
doesn't
like
want to do
King
that.
Charles, you are not here to be served. You're here to serve.
I am. I'm
and this
runner.
Is your queen.
It's ridiculous. And people are going, "Chris, we'll go and get that." And I go, "I can't. If I fob this off to you, she'll tell us off later."
You
I
could, like, I'm not okay. Could you go and get my thong, please, stranger I've never met? Or yeah. could my husband go and get it out of my suitcase?
Yes, okay, fair enough.
There you go.
Fair so enough. You talk about pontins,
yes.
blue coats.
Yeah.
We used to go to Butlins, red coats. Uh-huh. So, you know, pontins, that's got a certain ring to it. Butlins, these are all family names. Yeah. What about Ramses? I want to go to Ramses for my holiday.
Oh my gosh, do it, because that would be a dream come true.
That would be Rosie's genuinely. You've hit on something here.
But
that
he doesn't want to go to Ramses.
The holiday park. Oh my gosh.
Nighttime entertainment.
Yes.
Yeah, play park for the kids.
So,
yes.
So global TV show via the BBC, yeah. via BBC Worldwide. Yeah. Because that would only be fair. Uh-huh. Yeah. ITV Monday to Friday. after Phil, in for Phil and Holly, whatever.
Wow.
Right, uh-huh. Or afternoons. And then global network of theme parks.
Yes, please.
You are underestimating how lazy we are. You are underestimating how lazy we are, genuinely.
You're not lazy.
Sure.
Do you know what? You're not lazy. Just find what you do. Not easy, because I'm not saying it's easy, but it's your true nature. If you are basically shining a magnifying glass and a spotlight on your true nature, then you will be able to sustain that for longer, because it's who you are anyway. And that's what you two do.
Thanks.
What a lovely chat
this has been. Good for
the
day.
You're the best, guys.
Before I go, right, have I changed? Yes, I have changed. Shout out to me gardener, Simon. He texted us saying I was on the show today. He's a big fan. Shout out to Simon.
Oh, is he listening?
He better be working, but yeah.
All right, so listen, what a weekend it's going to be. What a couple of weekends we've had, haven't we? Bank holiday weekends, coronation.
Yeah. I know.
Eurovision this weekend, you guys on the telly tomorrow. It's not as bad as a lot of people are making out, everyone.
It's all right. It's going to be okay. It's all going to be okay.
Yeah.
You two have got to go. Where are you going next?
Oh gosh.
We're jumping on the tube and going somewhere. BBC? Woman's Hour, maybe. I might get an hour off.
Nice.
I'll sit outside.
Bring in the husband chat there. They'd love it.
Oh, yeah, they'd love it.
Chris and Rosie Ramsey. The Chris and Rosie Ramsey Show Series 2 returns from BBC 2 as Series 1 on BBC 1 tomorrow from 10:40. You're the best. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you, sir.
So all the best. All right, another massive intro for another massive guest. Vassos, over to you.
He's the greatest snooker player of all time, with 7 world titles and both the fastest ever maximum break and an annoyingly quick park run PB. His new autobiography, Unbreakable, is out today. And let's face it, snooker loopy nuts are we all, for Ronnie O'Sullivan.
Good morning, Ronnie.
How you doing? You all right, Chris? Yeah.
I'm really well. Thanks for coming in.
No, thanks for having me on.
What a book, mate.
I'm glad you like it. And yeah, I put a lot of work into it. Obviously, like, when you do a book, you want it to be as authentic, and people got to read it, you know. So I've got to want to do the best job we did. And me and Tom did. We put heart and soul into it.
Tell us about Tom quickly, Vassos.
Tom is a pal of mine. He might still work for the BBC. He definitely used to. He used to work for online, but he does a lot of these, or, you know, an acceptable amount. But he puts a lot of work into it. And you'll know this, Ronnie. He really makes it an effort to make sure it's your voice that comes through the pages. And it really is. I think he's done this. I think this might be his best autobiography ghosting.
Yeah, I mean, I was sat down with 3 different writers and I had to make a decision, and the one that done it for me was that he liked running, so I thought, sweet, we're going to run. Yeah. That was the deal breaker for me, like, writing a book. I just had to trust he knew what he was doing, and but really it was just that we had that common bond, and I thought, as long as we got that, we're gonna get on well, you know. Yeah. So but he's a serious guy. It's very different to my first two, where Simon was just, he's just all over the place, but brilliant because he's a bit of a genius. Tom, very structured. I'm not normally good with structure, but I got into it, and Tom and us, it's a different type of book. It's like he wanted to see snooker and the world through how I see it. So it was like, you know, I had to go through that sort of process of like trying to, like, how do I feel? What do I do to help? You know, because I don't normally think. It just comes instinctively, you know. You have to obviously try and get in the right, good place, but usually it just, you have to let it happen, you know. So it was like a bit of a therapy session as well, like, you know.
The first fascinating thing you've said in this interview, and there's going to be loads, is I'm not very good with structure. For a snooker player to say that is quite incredible until you read Ronnie's book, because it's all about the antithesis of what people think perceived you as for years anyway, and the mathematics of snooker and how that doesn't come into it where you're concerned. You are structured when it comes to practice. You're really tough on yourself. You're too tough on yourself, and you've recognised that via this book. It's not as much about running as it is about snooker, but it nearly is. The book in the end, it's brilliant. It begins, this is what it feels like when you're playing snooker well. When you're doing, not thinking. When the snooker gods are smiling on you, not pulling you apart. It's an energy in your body, walking around the table, in your mind, looking at the spread of the balls, settling down behind the white, the butt of the cue sitting in your right hand, your bridge hand out on the green cloth ahead of you, middle finger pointing the way like a needle on a compass. It's the best drug you've ever experienced. You felt it before, but it left you, and now it's returned. You recognise the lovely rush, and you want it to stay forever. Wow.
Yeah, well.
Does real life ever come close to that?
No, absolutely not. You know, I get a lot of pleasure out of life, don't get me wrong, cooking and going running and all that sort of stuff. But nothing compares to this, and it'll never be able to replace it either, because I'm never going to be as good at anything else as I have been at this. So it's kind of taken this game to as high a place as I could take it, and been better than pretty much everyone else that I've played against. So it's kind of a weird situation to be in, to kind of be able to boss pretty much most of your games, and that's a good feeling, you know.
And Sam, you know, the fact that you say I'll never be as good at anything else as I am at this, you're better at this than almost anybody in the world. You're arguably the greatest of all time. What does it feel like to be that good at something compared to the other 7.5 billion people on the planet?
Listen, there's some amazing talented players out there, and you have to be on your game just to try and be one step ahead of them, because that's all you ever are, even when you're at your best. So when you're not at your best, you're vulnerable. But for me, Stephen Hendry was my hero, the greatest player I've ever seen and played, so I'm happy to share that title if that's the case, but I've never put myself ahead of Stephen Hendry, because I wish I could be more like him. He was my hero. He's like, I watched how he done his business, and I was like, I wish I could be that guy, you know, but I'm not. But I've just managed to, like the title says, unbreakable. I've broken so many times, but I've just had to put myself back together. That's the difference, you know. Hendry didn't break, he was just like a machine, but I fell apart, had to get off the floor, fell apart, and I kind of got used to that all my life, but I've had to learn how to try and not fall apart so bad, and just, you know, just managed that side of me, really, you know.
It's an obvious metaphor, but, you know, at the beginning of every frame of snooker, you smash into the reds, you break up the organisation, the cosmos, the perfection of how the balls are laid out, and you try and get them back together, back to where they started. And that's sort of what the book's about, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's snooker is like, you if you look at the guy who's just won the world championship, Luca Brasil, you know, if you look at the way he plays, you go, it's not the way you're supposed to learn how to play the game, you know. It's very, you know, it's like, it's make it up as you go along. Very creative. Judd Trump as well. And that's, I kind of fall into that bracket. So when I say I'm not used to structure doesn't work for me, because we're like feeling players. If we feel good, then, you know, the game becomes limitless of options.
Yeah.
And that's how my life's kind of been. But I've had to learn to have structure within it, because without structure, you're all over the place.
That's
the
thing,
isn't it? Only so much structure I need, and I'm prepared to. Because if you go too that way, then I become like, I don't know, I lose my flow in a way, you know.
Yeah, but you need that stability, don't you? Stability is everything. And when you're really creative, it's often you perceive it as the enemy, but it's not really. No. It's your friend.
It's the framework. You know, at some point you have to have some sort of framework and some boundaries to go, okay, well, that's in place. We need that, because without that, you're never going to be a success. But within that, you can kind of play about with it a bit and sort of make your own rules up in a way. But it always comes back to having that solid framework. And, you know, anyone that's been successful in their career have realised that at some point, you know, I need that to operate, but within
boundaries.
That, then,
you need the boundaries, man.
Yeah.
You need the boundaries, because if you haven't got anything to push against, then you can't get any stronger, and you just in the end fall off the cliff. It's all in the book. It's very candid. It's very honest. I couldn't put it down. I read it in one hit yesterday.
Oh wow!
From cover to cover, and it didn't take me long. I've got to say, it's what a page turner. You talked about Stephen Hendry there. You talk about lots of amazing snooker players. You talk, one of the many interesting bits in the book is when you say that you yourself have felt closer to Stephen Hendry and Steve Davis than perhaps other people may have thought you were. In fact, they would put you close towards Alex Higgins and the punk aspect of snooker. Clearly, you get why they have perceived you like that.
Yeah.
And the surprise is that you don't. Just talk about that a bit.
Well, I was always drummed into me as a kid that Steve Davis was someone you should follow, you know, by my dad. So I kind of, as a young kid, I was built and, you know, that was how I went about, you know, trying to become the player I wanted to come. So really, Jimmy White and Alex Higgins were never like the people that I would follow. You know, I was always very meticulous, very tight on technique, very science based. And that's what you kind of, like we say, you know, you need that framework. And Steve Davis as well, and Hendry, so they were both sort of the people that I was always trying to be like, you know, if you like. But I had a brain that worked a bit quicker, so it was kind of like, that's why I think people go, oh, he's like Jimmy White, he's like Alex Higgins, because my brain thinks quicker, you know. Steve,
you're
Davis,
like a hybrid of the two in a way.
But when I was more going towards Alex Higgins, Jimmy White, which was pure instinct, I couldn't win the world championships, which was like something I always wanted to do. So I had to take my game apart, which I've mentioned in a book. In 2000, went to see a coach in Bristol, Frank Anderson, who I'd seen what he'd done with other players, and I went, if you can do that with me, then I can become world champion. But if I had never changed, I would never have become world champion. So I realized that early on, because I lost myself for 6-7 years. You know, as a kid I was brilliant technically. You know, I had the game, and then I kind of self-taught myself from 17 to 24 and ruined my game. You know, I become like a pool player, really. You know, I was like, didn't even look like a snooker player. So I needed someone to help me.
But if you're at the centre, you can't see it.
You can't.
That's why you need a coach.
You need a coach, yeah.
And not just a playing coach, but also a mental coach.
Well, yeah.
Tell us about Steve Peters.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, he was like the icing on the cake, really, because when I got my game right, I kind of like, that gave me the confidence and the, you know, and I knew how to get through matches. We're all mentally strong on the tour, but sometimes it's your form that can like drain you. And if your form's not great for long periods of time, you just give up. So once I got my game right and I was more consistent, I was able to sort of keep the momentum going. But then, you know, obviously I won the world championships, I win tournaments, but I'd go missing for certain matches. And it was like, I didn't know how to dig in because I wasn't prepared to, I didn't believe I could win by not playing my best. Steve Peters changed that and kind of went, look, we're not going to sabotage anymore, because that's what I was doing. And I didn't realise I was doing it until he kind of pointed it out to me and showed me. And I was like, yeah, I do that. So once I stopped doing that, I started to win certain games and then find my feet and then find my form. And I was like, wow, this is great. So then obviously the levels of consistency were much higher just through applying some mental skills, you know.
Yeah, and snooker matches can be so long, you can't be on the offensive all the time. And you thought it was either win or lose, and it was day or night. And he's saying, no, there's the morning and the afternoon.
Yeah.
As long as you stay neutral, and you talk about staying neutral in the book.
Just staying neutral, just staying in that sort of, in the moment, really, and just sort of like one ball at a time. I'm like, one ball at a time, I'm already thinking about the final. I'm already thinking, like, if I get my game right, this is in the bag. So, you know, he was like, no, let's just stay more present, because it's, you're going to have your ups and downs. Yeah. It's just life. And I was like, okay.
You can't win in the future.
No, no.
You've got to win in the here and now.
Exactly. So it was kind of like about retraining my, what I, you know, the truths of life, really, you know, because my truths were like unreasonable. You know, like you said, I was hard on myself. So I was trying to live up to these truths. And Steve went, if we can change them and be a bit more realistic and a bit more like, you know, what's attained and what's what, you know, the rules of snooker is no one is consistent all the time. And I was like, really? And I was like, okay. So he said, as long as you learn them rules, you can accept them and move on and just do the best that you can do. So I worked really hard on that, but I still fall apart.
It's a story of three Steves as well, the book.
Yeah.
Because you got Steve Peters, you got Stephen Hendry, you got Steve Davis.
Yeah.
Steve Davis was one of your first coaches?
Well, I used to, from TV, so obviously never got to meet him, but I used to study him on TV, so I'd watch everything.
What did you learn? What was his strengths?
His strengths were just his setup. He's just how he kind of get behind the ball, his feet would be together, the routine and the stillness, and was just unbelievable. You know, he was like he was like when Tiger Woods came along, it was like a different game. Yeah. He was just so much better than everybody else because of the discipline, the routine. Because snooker is like a, it's like, you know, you have to pot a lot of balls. You know, it's not like a moment of magic. It's like you need to like continuously get from one ball to the next.
And there's no momentum because the balls aren't coming at you in like in football and tennis. Exactly. It's a still ball sport.
So if you miss hit one, it's not the ball's fault. It's your fault. Yeah. So you kind of have to internalise a lot of this and kind of go, well, I'm to blame. You know, it's not, you know, you can't blame the weather, the conditions. It's like, this is as flat as it gets.
Yeah.
There's no role, you know what I mean? So, you know, that's why he became my coach. And
every time you answer a question, I think of 10 more, and I'm trying to stick on the best ones, because you talk about there's no weather in sport, but there is different atmospheres in different arenas, different sound, different ambience. And you're saying, there are better venues than other venues.
Oh, absolutely. Theatre creates theatre. Right. Leisure centres create nothing.
Yeah.
So when we play in the leisure centre,
everything gets lost.
Yeah. It just doesn't. It's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay.
It's an industrial space, therefore. Yeah, it's an industrial, less artistic.
Just doesn't
game.
Work basically for snooker.
Isn't that amazing?
But the Crucible Theatre is too much, though. I think I don't know whether it's because we're used to playing in leisure centres and you get used to the atmosphere, and then they put you in the Crucible and you're like, what is going on here?
It's like Mastermind. Everything goes quiet.
It's horrible.
Time starts
even
now.
When you're flying and you're at your best, it is the most horrendous 17 days that you put yourself through. I don't care, you know, and I've spoke to other snooker players just to kind of check out whether I'm not right or that, you know, and they all say the same. Steve Davis, Stephen Hendry, the greatest players that ever played this game. People that don't have good results here come and speak to me and go, I just can't play there. And I'm like, yeah, I'm the same, mate. I feel exactly the same. I said, but what choice we got? We got
it's the biggest stage in the world, isn't it?
I don't know what it is about that tournament.
Intensity.
They're so close.
Yeah.
The
history's there as well.
Yeah. It's just. I don't know what it is. I still
feel
can't work
out.
Because it was like
he's scratching his neck and he's.
I need time off after that. I take 2 weeks off. I just don't move out the house because it's just like.
The extreme from a capacity point of view is this new 9,000-seater Hong Kong arena. Yeah. So how does that compare?
That was a doddle. That was the easiest bit of work I've ever had in my life. And that suits me because they were quite a way away, like in a basketball arena. But it was still acoustic-wise, it was great. And
Why was it good, acoustic-wise?
Because...
I'd imagine.
It didn't feel like a basketball arena. It felt like they'd kind of... They decorated it well, so they put nice curtains, nice carpets, nice lighting. You know,
the soundproofing.
Yeah, and it kind of like it worked really well. So for me, that was easy. So it's not even about the number of people. The Crucible only holds like 950 people.
Yeah,
it's just that they're on top
of
you.
10x.
They're breathing on you. You know what I mean? They're like, you know, you're like,
and they know their sport and they love their sport.
Yeah.
Wow. Let's talk about sound a bit more. So you said that when. Steve Davis hits the cue ball.
Yeah.
It sounds like nobody else hitting the cue ball. And you thought, when I hit the cue ball, it doesn't sound like that. I need to get it to sound more like that. Mm. What's all that about, Ronnie?
Well, it's a bit like you know, you can be sitting in your chair, and that's what I was saying about Luca Purcell. When he hits the ball, you can just, you know, he's...
You know it's him.
Before he's hit it.
Could you go on YouBet and identify who's playing... Snooker from the sound of the cue
ball. Yeah, you can just tell. We play by sound. So when I was with Ray Reardon, he said, don't even look at the table, just listen.
Right.
He said, you know if they've hit it well or not. And certain players hit the ball so well. And,
so
you know,
truly,
crisply. It has a different noise. And I'm sure it's like it in most sports. Tiger Woods hitting the golf ball. They always say it sounds differently. But yes, Davis was, you know, when most players hit, it's tinny. You think, is his cue not screwed up properly?
Yeah.
When Davis hit the ball, it was like a boom. You thought,
ouch.
You know what I mean? And when you're sitting in your chair and you're hearing that, it does knock
you. It's like getting hit by Tyson.
It's like a mental hit. You know, it's
amazing.
Not a physical hit, it's a mental hit. Because then you think, I need to respond. And mine's like, tinny. You can't compete over a long period of time.
Do you remember the first time you hit a cue ball as well as that?
I said it in a book. And I think it was when I was 12, when I was in a tournament and I just hit this bit of form. I don't know where it come from, but I literally knew I was going to clear up before I'd even gone to the table. And the balls were just sounding differently strong. And that's when I went, this is like I say, it's like a superpower.
Yeah.
I felt unplayable. You know, it didn't matter who was sitting in the chair. I thought it could be Steve Davis, Stephen Hendry. I'm not going
to
miss.
See, it's interesting, isn't it? Because that's the difference between you having to take on the player and just take on the game. Because sometimes you do have to annihilate the opponent psychologically. But when you're at that level of form, that's not an ingredient.
No. Listen, everyone brings a reputation. You know, John Higgins, when you play him, you know you're in for a heart. You're not going to get nothing free.
Yeah.
But you also know that if you get on a roll, you can push ahead of him.
Yeah.
Other players like Luca Brasil, you can be pushing ahead of him. But if he decides, like, I'm feeling good, you can sit in your chair for 7-8 frames. So everyone brings a different and keeps you on your toes, you know, and you kind of have to be wary of that. But at the end of the day, all you can do is play your game as well as you can for as long as you can, and then just fingers crossed and just go, like, hopefully snooker gods
wait for it to come to you,
shining on me, and I get over the line, you know,
because that we chase runs away, man. That's the thing, isn't it? You talk about Tiger Woods quite a lot in the book. What did you learn from him? What similarities have you witnessed between him and yourself?
I think very, very obviously winning is the only thing I can sort of go take from him and sort of go, well, that's where I've tried to get, you know. He's just on another level.
But you talk about his lack of self-esteem and recognising that, him not realising how good he is.
I watched something of him, a show on a TV, and I couldn't quite believe how he didn't feel how unbelievable he was, you know. And sometimes I think he was sort of, I can't remember, but it was quite an interesting thing. But it was just sort of like, it was for him, it was just all about the winning, and I just thought, when you get into that thing of just all about the winning, sometimes you lose the just going out there and just playing golf or just going playing snooker.
It's called playing, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think at some point you just got to go, I just want to play, and I'm happy, you know. I love the game, and I phoned Steve Davis up about 6 months ago. I said, Steve, like, you know, you're ahead of me in the game, but I'd just like to just cross-reference where I am. Am I doing all right? You know, I said, because sometimes I switched off from it's all about the wins to just, I just love the game, you know. But I said, is that wrong? I said, I feel guilty sometimes for just enjoying the game, you know, because I know it takes something away from being a winner. But if I tried to be a winner, I think I wouldn't want to play anymore because it's too stressful at my age. And he said, you're doing the right thing. He said, if you can just enjoy it and have fun, he said, that's great. He said, because if I could, he said, I'd have kept playing.
Yeah.
He said, but I didn't. So I went, fair enough. He said, so as long as you're enjoying it. And I thought, okay, that's cool. You know, I'm not sure I'd enjoy getting beat first round 4-0, 4-0, 4-0, 4-0 and putting all the practice in. So if that day ever come, then I might have to reconsider whether it's worth playing. But at the moment, it's not like that, you know.
I have 1,000 questions. Because when I was reading your book, I started to write questions. And I realised by the end of the chapter, I had more questions than the pages in that chapter. And the more you answer, the more... I love talking to you about this. I'm fascinated by this. Mm. It's one of the sort of most sort of profound books I've ever read when it comes to a potential source of questions. Mm. Where should we go next? We can go anywhere next. Let's talk about you and Damien Hirst, your relationship there, your friendship there, which is sincere, it's genuine. How did that happen? You know, how frequently do you see each other, and what do you get up to together?
Yeah, so obviously Damien came to see me play 2008. We didn't actually meet until he was just about to leave, so fate obviously stepped in and we bumped each other on the stairs. And was like, he said, right, I've got to go. I said, oh, great, great, you come and watch. Like, here's my number. Like, maybe we'll stay in contact. And then we met up, and within about 20, 30 seconds of meeting him, I went, I really like this fella. You know, he just had this way about him, his presence. I went, very, very down to earth and unaffected by what you think people like Damien would be, you know?
Yeah.
So the perception and the real him is, you know, he's just a normal fella from Leeds, really, that just likes having a kebab in my room, and we sit there and we watch the snooker, and he just makes me laugh. We just have he's one of the funniest people I think I've ever met in my life.
And he's been through the mill.
Yeah, he's different characters to me, though, because he's sort of like, he can't understand how I just want to play well and not really worry about the results. But sure, it's just about winning. But he's got to know me, and there he kind of like goes, look, your well-being is more important than anything in the world. So I love that he's got my well-being at first.
And so,
we just, you know, we spend a lot of time together. So we'll spend like maybe 17 days at Sheffield. We're in each other's space pretty much all the time. comes to tournaments, and that's what it's like at tournaments. And then, you know, now I kind of go to see him where he does his work, and he'll get me
you
doing...
You get involved, don't you?
Yeah, I love it. I absolutely love it. I absolutely love it. So, you know, mixing
so if we buy... If in the future we buy an original hearse, might be a bit of a O'Sullivan in there as well.
Not really.
Have you ever put a dot on a painting?
Yeah, I mean, he'll have a corner out there and he'll go, right, like, you know...
That's the hearse I want.
Go and do that little section over there, and like me and... We'll just do a few bits and pieces.
Because his dot paintings look like snooker balls. Have you ever talked about that connection?
I always ask him, like you know, about certain stuff about, you know, because there's certain stuff I love, and I go, well, what's your favourite bit of work? This and that, and he says, well, I like this and I like that. And but his mind's on
how does he do the dots? Are they silhouetted or...?
I don't know about how he does the dots. I know he does the blobs, right. The blossoms, because obviously I've been there and watched it all done, right. And it's just layers upon layers, and then all of a sudden you look at it, and then he'll just be looking at it, and then he'll just put two little yellows there, and you're like... And it's just...
How it just
Yeah, and it's just like the one or two
Have
dots.
Have you learned there must be from him?
Loads, yeah. So when we went to Sheffield, I said, right, I said, my therapy is art therapy. I said, you know, so I said, because I'll take my own art away to tournaments. And right. He said, right, leave it to me. I'm sorting it. So we had this sort of like these canvases brought up, little mini ones, little pens, and we were just sitting there dotting. And so I had like 2 weeks of art coaching.
Best.
And I'd be there and he'd go, oh, that looks great. It needs a bit of this, it needs a bit of that. And I'm like, well, go on then, show me what it like. And then all of a sudden it'd be like a few little oranges and you're like, wow, yeah, it brings it alive. So, I love it. You know, I like things that I get lost in. So
does
for
he
me,
play?
Yeah, he plays.
Is he any good?
Yeah, he's decent. He can pot a ball. He can make 30s. He's fascinated by the angles and how you kind of like, you know, but he gets it as well, you know. So, like, the reason why I know he gets it is because when I've hit a ball good, he'll look at me and his little face goes like that. And I know that he knows.
Yeah.
You know, because that's not, most people don't know. And I'm like, you know, like, so you can't explain it to him.
But when he's that aware of what's going on around him, he's going to hear it. And
yeah,
see
but
it.
Like, he doesn't play snooker. So I'm like, yeah, you feel it. He feels it. And it's the
but
flow.
You meet on a bridge.
Yeah, it's kind of like weird, but it works. It does work.
God, we're nearly out of time. Right. So your mum, the snooker room at your mum's.
Yeah.
How important is that? What's the most important table in your life?
That was the one that I had. Obviously, I had to sell it because they changed the make of the table, so I had to get a new one. But that's going there because my mum's selling the house. She's downsizing, but I've built my own room, so it's somewhere I can go and practice.
And what about this Q, your latest magic wand, which you just love so much, don't you?
Yeah, it's really difficult to get a good one. And when you get it, you're like, you want to keep it, and you're very hesitant to have work done on it. And
but they have a shelf life.
Well, they do with me because I changed the tip so many times that the tip gets smaller and smaller. Then you've got to like knock a bit of wood off of it, then it loses its feel and its balance, and then you think, oh, am I better off just getting a new one, or should I stick with this one and try and like make it right again? So you kind of like, I have 5 different cues, so I can give my main one a bit of a rest so as I don't wear it out, because I want it to like basically get to the end of my career if I can, you know.
Well, when is that going to be?
Don't want to put a number on it.
What do you sense? Ballpark, not a number, just ballpark.
Probably 55.
55. Why 55? 55,
because I think, like, I look at Steve Davis and Stephen, and they could still play then. I'm a little bit, and I've managed to, like, keep reinventing myself.
It's a lot of bending over, isn't it? Like, mechanics really struggle as they
get older. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, if you look at my, like, body, like, I'm all twisted all over the place.
Yeah, you have a lot of pyro, don't you?
Yeah, I try and sort of, like, balance it out with other stuff. But, you know, as long as I can keep playing, enjoying it. The problem for me... is if I stop and I've got nothing to do.
Yeah.
So it's not about the money or this or that. It's more about, have I got an interest to get me out of bed in the morning? Because if I haven't, then I'm it's not
good
for me.
Well, running's meeting you halfway there, isn't it?
Gets me there, but I only get out early to run because I know I've got to go to work at 10, 11 o'clock. Whereas if I didn't have the work, I'd probably sleep in, and I don't want to sleep in
Well,
either.
There's ultras you could go on and do and things like that.
Oh, yeah, but then you're like, your whole life is just spent just being alone.
I've got
family and friends, and I don't want to be.
And you've made
person.
Up for all that now as well. I mean, the book is as much about your personal life as it is about your professional life. Mm. It's just, I mean, we are out of time, Ronnie. I hope you can tell that I could talk to you forever.
Thank you. No, it's been so great.
It's a really wonderful book. It's just the best book.
Thank you.
I couldn't recommend it highly enough. Ronnie O'Sullivan, Unbreakable. Great to meet you, Ronnie.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.